have two readings for you this morning. The first one is from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Compassion is not a religious business. It is a human business. It is not a luxury. It is essential for our own peace and mental stability. It is essential for human survival. And our second reading is from Henry Nouwen, and he is a Catholic monk. In a world so torn apart by rivalry, anger, and hatred, we have the privileged location to be living signs of a love that can bridge all divisions and heal all wounds. So our theme this month is journey. And journey is a metaphor that we use to describe life. Life is a journey, we say. We have destinations. We take one road and not another. We plan where we are going. We take wrong turns and wrong paths. We have guides and maps to help us find us on our way. I say we use this journey as a metaphor because journey is considered a conceptual metaphor in 21st century American English speaking people. It comes to us in our language and is so omnipresent that it forms how we think about our very lives. We are in fact forced by our language to consider our lives as journeys. One of the oldest stories told and retold in Western culture is the story of Odysseus, in the story called The Odyssey. In English today, Odyssey is not just the name of Odysseus's journey, but means a long, eventful journey with some meaning or some significance. When we undergo an Odyssey, we change. We are on a life journey, we might say. Or we might say we are on a personal journey or a spiritual journey. We have places we are going and destinations we seek. We are expectant, preparing for new places and new experiences. Perhaps we have lessons we see ourselves learning as we go on this journey through life. Perhaps fate puts obstacles in our road, and we take new paths or climb over those obstacles or confront them and vanquish them so we continue on our path, on our journey. The story of Odysseus is called a hero's journey, and this pattern of story has been told for millennia. You know the hero's journey, whether you know it or not, by heart. A person leaves home, enters some new world, some different kind of experience they haven't had before. And in this new world, they find friends and mentors. And they have obstacles in their paths and things they must overcome as they develop skills in this new, different experience or world. And then at some point, they have to fight their greatest fear. And they fight for their very being. And then they win. And then they return home, a changed person. The Odyssey is the story. The Wizard of Oz could perhaps be one of the clearest tellings of the hero's journey. Star Wars and Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter are all hero's journeys. Most of us never tire, it seems, of hearing the hero's journey. It's the journey of the human spirit, the way we change from one way of being to another way of being. And while the Odyssey and the Wizard of Oz and the Lord of the Rings are literal journeys, many journeys are not literal. They're metaphorical. We don't go anywhere new. Our Odysseys are in our minds, in our bodies, and in our spirits. The world cannot be discovered by a journey of miles, says the poet Wendell Berry, no matter how long, but only by a spiritual journey, a journey of 1 inch, very arduous and humbling and joyful, by which we arrive at the ground at our own feet and learn to be at home. So Wolf's mission reads partly, we will grow in compassionate community. Growing like metaphor, like journey, is a metaphor for change. If you grow, you start as a seed, you push through the soil, you sprout stems and leaves, and then you blossom, and then you bear fruit. Wolf's mission statement could easily read as easily, we will journey into compassionate community, has the same idea of change ourselves. Wolf's mission is an incredibly important mission, both for ourselves individually and for the world we live in. The journey toward compassion, toward increasing our capacity for compassion, is so sorely and deeply needed in our world right now. Our world desperately needs compassion. And you all know this. I started writing lists of reasons why we all need compassion in the world, but realized, you know, you too are experts on this. So I want us to just pause for a moment, and I want you to think in your own minds of the places where you have noticed in your personal life, in your extended community, in the world, where there could just be the use of a little more compassion. Just take a moment. And then if you like, but only if you like, I would like you to turn to a neighbor, maybe only a neighbor of three, if somebody in your or near you wants to stay silent, thinking, and share. What are some places you think there could be a little more compassion? I was actually told in the worship committee to never let you talk to each other because you'll never stop. Guess I'm learning. So compassion is actually the ability to feel what someone else is feeling and then wanting, if they are suffering, to change that experience for them. And it has been an important religious principle for 2,500 years. It was Confucius in the 6th century BCE who was the first person in the history of the world, as far as we know, to articulate the golden rule. Confucius was asked which of his teachings his disciples should practice all day and every day. He said, never do to others what you would not like done to yourself. Confucius was one of the great thinkers of the Axial Age, a time of rich ethical and religious thinking that spanned 600 years from the 8th to the 2nd century BCE, and it touched most of the world, at least the old world. All of the great faiths or their immediate ancestors came into being during this time, mostly completely independently of one another. In India, Hinduism and Buddhism rose up during those 600 years. In China, Confucianism and Taoism. In the Middle East, monotheism. And in Greece, philosophical rationalism. And while people have made incredible strides in terms of science and technology in that 2,500 years, religious scholars argue that human beings have made almost no new religious insights since that great age. Instead, we keep reinterpreting and recycling the crucial understandings that they came up with about what it means to be human and our relationships with each other and the world. We just keep making those insights new for the current times. And interestingly, today, the findings of psychology and neuroscience continue to demonstrate the brilliant thinking of that time in regard to human nature and our basic ways of thinking and being and what is possible for us to think and be. The Axial Age was a time of radical changes in the world. People were settling more permanently into cities. Market economies began to thrive, and violence and war were all too common. People everywhere were struggling with how to be human and find meaning in this new time. One message was common to all of the axial religions. We must practice the golden rule. We must practice compassion. We must be kind, not only among those who we love and know, but we must practice compassion for the stranger, and even more difficultly, practice compassion for our enemies. Today, we live in a time of even faster, more radical changes than the Axial Age. Almost nothing about how we live would be recognizable to someone from 100 years ago, and even less recognizable to someone who lived 150 or 200 years ago. And at the same time, we have become linked in tighter, more intense ways with people all over the world. What we do every day affects people everywhere, including driving our cars, the clothing we wear, the ideas that we espouse and are seen through our televisions and radios and on the internet. Today, the messages of the Axial Age are more important than they ever have been. Religious thinkers all over the world and leaders such as Pope Francis and the Dalai Lama continue to preach this message. Only with compassion, they argue, can our world become a safe place where all of us could flourish. In 2007, Karen Armstrong, a prolific and well-respected religious historian, won the TED Prize. She was given $100,000 and a wish for a better world. And what she did was she returned to the great thinkers of the Axial Age. She wished for a world grounded in compassion. She began the process to create the Charter of a Compassion, which was a joint effort between people across faith traditions and the secular world. The charter begins, "The principle of compassion lies at the heart of all religious, ethical, and spiritual traditions, calling us always to treat others as we wish to be treated ourselves. Compassion impels us to work tirelessly to alleviate the suffering of our fellow creatures, to dethrone ourselves from the center of our world and put another there, and to honor the inviolable sanctity of every single human being, treating everybody without exception with absolute justice, equity, and respect." Based on her work as a religious historian and also as a scholar of contemporary religion, Armstrong believes in the power of compassion. And I believe in it too. I imagine what it would be like if the United Methodists, who just voted against the inclusion of gay people in the religious community, spent the days in the shoes of a gay United Methodist minister. Might they have voted differently? I imagine what it would be like if those who find migrants fleeing from their dangerous countries, so dangerous and difficult to be in our own countries, spent their day in the shoes of one of those migrants. Perhaps our immigration system would be a more compassionate and different system. If they were just all more compassionate, wouldn't the world be kinder? I just have no doubt of that. Of course, if they were more compassionate isn't exactly the point. Those who advocate for a compassionate attitude toward others would not find it very appropriate for me to sling someone else's lack of compassion back at them like a weapon, because the point is everyone being compassionate, including me. Clearly, my cry of "they" or "those people" demonstrates a certain lack of compassion. or ability to be in their shoes and see why they do what they do. If I choose to embark upon a journey of compassion, and I am the one who is called to be compassionate, not to demand that of others. It's not something you can demand of someone. In the charter, I am asked to work tirelessly to alleviate the suffering of our fellow creatures, to dethrone ourselves from the very center of our world and put another there, which seems hard to do. But the Charter of Compassion continues. It is also necessary in both public and private life to refrain consistently and empathetically from inflicting pain, to act or speak violently out of spite, chauvinism, or self-interest, to impoverish, exploit, or deny basic rights to anybody, and to incite hatred by denigrating others, even our enemies, is a denial of our common humanity. So all of that seems somewhat easy at first, particularly not acting violently or agreeing not to deny anyone's rights. I never agree to that. But on a closer reading, it seems a little hard. Not denigrating our enemies? Does that mean the people who've hurt me for their own gain, I'm not supposed to denigrate them? Or the people who disagree vehemently with me politically? Not denying basic rights does seem pretty easy to me, unless it means all the ways that my government denies rights with my tax dollars, with my consent, because I don't stop it, by killing unarmed black people or keeping asylum seekers in torturously cold detention centers. When I carefully consider the actual demands of compassion, it seems like a journey. I start with one capacity for compassion and hope to move down the road toward a deeper capacity for compassion, a deeper understanding of what being a compassionate person means. Compassion can be so natural and so easy, like compassion for babies or for children, particularly our own children, our families and our closest friends and our communities of people who we love. For me, that's easy compassion to offer. But compassion can also be really, really difficult when we are confronted by people who we do not know, who are unlike us, and act in ways we find deplorable. Right now, though, the world needs not just compassion for those closest to us, but compassion for those beyond us. So I just want you to take another moment and to think of people or the types of things that people do who you have compassion for, those ones who are easy. And then I want you to think a little bit about those who you don't have compassion for typically. You must have some. It was easy for me. So just take a moment. And I'm going to do this thing again and let you talk to each other. So if you're comfortable, if you just want to be by yourself, please do. But share with your neighbor, people who you find it easy to be compassionate for and people who you find more challenging. And try to include everyone, but don't include people who don't want to be included. So. So moving down the road, so there's a road there. There's the people who we feel that we can be compassionate with, and that's easy for us. And then there's the people who it's hard to be compassionate for, and there's probably some people in between, I think so. And so that's the journey. The journey is moving down the road to grow our capacity for compassion. And that is actually a spiritual or personal journey. It's one that we actually are asked to take by the mission of this congregation to grow into compassionate community. And that means learning to be compassionate ourselves, each of us, and also to be compassionate as a body as we are in the world. So how do you do this? What is the journey we are asking ourselves to take? Are there maps? Are there guides, suggested routes and paths and roads for growing compassionately? Well, it turns out that there are. So the first thing to be aware of is the spiritual or personal journey. And over, the sages and now psychologists teach that if you take a journey into suffering and find your way through that particular experience and journey, compassion is often one of the gifts that you are rewarded with. And this can be any sort of suffering, from the loss of a loved one, a job, a dream, a home, or maybe sickness, or an accident, or a natural disaster, or a failure at work, or a failure at school, or maybe feelings of worthlessness, depression, or loneliness. What is important is how you journey through the suffering. Are you curious about it? Do you make discovery? Do you find new friends and mentors to guide you? Do you gain some new skills while you're inside of that suffering? Are there new ways that you can walk and do? And then usually with the suffering, you get to face your greatest fear. At least your greatest fear at that time, or one of the myriad of greatest fears, I don't know. So there's a lot of great fears. One is that you'll never be loved for who you are. Death. To always be alone. Your capacity for meanness. Your lack of knowledge and skill. Your worry that you'll never be worthy or perfect. And there are so many more. At that moment, when you're face to face with the fear, the stories tell us, you need to stay. Running and taking a different path just don't work. I mean, really, most of us are going to run sometimes. There's lots of paths to run away on. There's shopping and television and alcohol and food and romance and excessive planning, extreme busyness, to name a few American favorites. However, on the spiritual journey, sometimes you just have to stick around and face whatever that fear is, whatever that pain is. And the trick is to wrap that fear in your arms and be gentle and kind with it. And then it opens your heart. That's the promise of the stories. When you discover your own strength and befriend your own demons, the stories promise you will receive gifts. And so often what that gift is the ability to appreciate others and have compassion for them. So that's one path through. The others are all actually have some relationship to that one. Another path is just to intentionally decide that you're going to nurture compassion in you. Compassion, by psychologists, is considered to be a muscle. It's like lifting weights. You can actually do strengthening exercises. You can set yourself up, actually, for mini hero journeys. So there's this one practice that one man has done, which is he's trying to develop compassion for animals and people and countries. So what he does is he gets on and he watches television or reads the news or gets on the internet and just watches horrible things like earthquakes and fires and terrorist attacks. And then he really feels for and imagines feeling the pain of those who are involved with that situation. And what he recognizes is himself is he doesn't want to feel that pain. He doesn't want to know what it's like to have your house burned down and you're standing there and the reporters have those microphones on your face. How are you feeling? And imagining what a person might feel like. And just staying with that. And what he's discovered is that he opens and feels connected to all beings. So So that is one possible type of practice, is using our imagination to connect with others. Another way to grow in compassion is mindfulness meditation. When we meditate with a focus on breath or sound, and simply note what comes into our minds, studies show that this really does increase our feelings of compassion. It can also be used as a mini hero's journey, as sometimes in meditation, feelings or thoughts come up that we don't like, and we need to learn to sit with them with kindness and affection, sort of preparing us for those bigger hero's journeys. Another possibility for walking a path of compassion is practicing simple kindnesses, like the girl in today's story. She too took a mini hero's journey as she struggled her own way to be kind. She was thrown into a new situation when Tanisha spilled juice, and she didn't have any idea what to do. It was a new experience. So she spends the whole story looking for maps and guides to help her on her journey to kindness. And she finally comes up with a solution to just be with Tanisha. And what happens is she added another pathway to her personal guidebook for kindness. And that's something that you can do as well. So Buddha, 2,500 years ago, invented a loving kindness meditation intended for the very purpose of guiding people towards compassion. During his daily meditation, Buddha would attend to, he said, as the four immeasurable minds of love. That huge, expansive, immeasurable feeling that shows no hatred, he said. And he would direct this feeling, that feeling of love and compassion, to all the creatures of the world. And he credited this practice in part to his achieving of nirvana. And his meditation is practiced from that time till this by people all over the world. And we were fortunate to sing a version of this loving kindness meditation this morning. And it's one that you can practice in your own life every day, before bed, before meals, when you wake up, when you're feeling less loving and kind. So that's another practice. But really, one of the most important parts of any journey is the companions that you find along the way. Every journey has companions, companions to help you, to support you, to hold your hand, to remind you of what you were doing in the first place. Companions have all sorts of functions on a journey. You just need to ask Dorothy or Frodo about companions. They had a lot of them and a lot to say. And the thing that's really lucky for us is that we are blessed in this congregation to have each other as companions as we journey into compassionate community. And so what I want to recommend as we take these journeys of compassion is that we lean on each other. So we actually have a few moments for questions, comments, thoughts, for the good of all.
I'd like to share you my reaction to your talk about the Dalai Lama and this problem. No, I'm 86 years old. I was born in America. I went to China when I was 2 years old. And my family is sort of mixed. My mother was a little aristocratic, meaning that she was one of few women in China who was educated. And my father was also not as rich as my mother, but on the peasant side. So the way I was raised at home was that we were always taught the Confucian classics, which means that in our family, the Confucian were about five books. One of the books on what's called filial piety, which was the relationship between the child and his parents, and then the parents in relationship to the village head, and so, you know, the hierarchy. And I was always taught to study hard and pass the imperial exam, because, you know, that was like a Chinese sort of service, you know. And then this was how you get ahead, and my father, big. Be a big crook, a big official, just be big. You know, that was. Then when I came to America, I was taught Western democracy, you know, I went to university here. I learned about Plato, Socrates, all the controversy between democracy and dictatorship. And, you know, I was an economics major and I studied by feudalism. But when I hear the word Dalai Lama, you know, for me it's a mixed bag in the sense that the Tibetan society in China was a theocracy. You know, Tibet and China have been intertwined for several thousand years. And the Chinese have always interfered in the Tibetan business. But I feel so very touchy when I hear people say that Dalai Lama is a great hero. I'm well aware he's the martyr of lots of people. He got the Nobel Prize. But for me, he is the heir of a theocratic society. I know we as Unitarians, we had our problems with God, how the church structure, theology. You know, we had a witch hunt. Right. And then in Tibet, you had the same thing. And Tibet was reabsorbed in the Chinese Empire in 1950 Mao. And I was taught at that time that the Tibetan society was a theocracy. They had the aristocrat and they had the serf, you know. And right. That was no hero to us, for us who were the liberal left. And the Americans had tried to intervene in Tibet. The CIA had bombed China, in quote, in defense of Tibet. You know, so Tibetan history is intertwined with world politics, American politics, you know. And that's my uneasiness when I hear. You know, yeah. I'm not trying to defend Dalai Lama. I know people change through the ages. You know, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah. You know, that's what
Thank
I
you
say.
For that insight. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Whenever I hear the golden rule, I'm reminded what Peter Sorrell, I first heard from Peter Sorrell about the platinum rule, which is do unto others what they would have you do unto them.
Yeah. And I think that is a nice revision for our times because we've learned a lot about culture and how some things that in one culture would be respectful and wonderful in another culture would be insulting or difficult. So as we've learned more about cultures, that is a good revision of the golden rule for modern times. Yep.
Thank you, Tracy. Could you break down the word and use passion and passionate in relation to compassion?
You know, I don't know that etymology. The etymology that I'm more aware of is... Yeah, I'm forgetting it. I did read the whole etymology of compassion before I did this sermon, but I actually don't remember, so I can't actually speak to that.
So this morning in the Buddhist group, we talked a lot about self-compassion and compassion and the relationship, and our facilitator, Tom, put together some great notes for us, and I don't see him, but hopefully he won't mind if I... different Tom, sorry. But I wanted to read just a short passage of what he
Thank
had
you.
Written. If you do have ill will, which is natural at times, don't try to separate from it. Be with it and find the home of the energy involved, likely some kind of hurt or feeling of damage, and be with it there. Then you'll be able to act with the same empathy in the world.
Yeah. So there's a nice summary of the sermon. Perfect. That's great. And you know, that's another resource that we have here for growing into compassion is our Buddhist group, because they practice meditation and also do readings from Buddhist tradition, which a lot of it is about learning to be compassionate people. And they meet Sunday mornings and Wednesday evenings. You can look on our websites for the specifics. So that's another route that resource we have here to help people do that.
And that was a little bit of a response to this, but just asking to speak to the idea of being a compassionate responder when you feel that there's grave injustice, when you feel that there's timely action needed, how to remain in that rather than going to the anger and blame mm-hmm. and other non-compassionate options.
So I think the first piece is that... that if you do feel angry and you do feel bitter and you know, all those emotions come up because, you know, injustice does make us angry and it should. Like, that's like a motivating, powerful force. However, the nice thing about compassion or meditation is that you can feel that anger, feel that bitterness, feel the fear or whatever it is, and then say, okay, this might be motivating me, but I'm not going to act from this. And what I'm going to act from is the compassion piece. So that's nonviolence, actually. Nonviolence action is all about that. It's about, you know, this is unjust, it's wrong, there's rage, but we are going to act in a way that is a compassionate, direct action for our, for what we want to do, for the change we want to make. And in fact, we need to close. So this will be our last question.
I can have a great deal of compassion, or some compassion at least, for the Adolf Schicklgruber, who went through World War I, who suffered through the horrible economic conditions in Germany that were imposed by the Allies. I have very little or no compassion for the Adolf Hitler he became. I do not believe that nonviolence would work against the Gestapo.
Yeah.
And I think there's a limit to compassion and nonviolence.
Yeah.
And I say this as somebody who suffered a great deal of violence as a child.
Yeah.
So.
No, let me address that, which is, it's complicated when you get out on the edges there where there's really violence and there are people. I mean, I believe that there's people who are sociopaths who don't care, or maybe in Hitler's case was so, I don't know, I can't really speak to his whole situation. But I mean, there's people like that in the world, absolutely, who are dictators, who do evil consistently and regularly. And how do we hold that within this too? That's just another sort of piece of the conversation as you grow into capacity of compassion. So I think, it's definitely one of the things you need to grapple with and figure out where you stand on. So this is our benediction. For beginning, even when the path ahead is unclear, for the courage it takes to trust that the way will reveal itself, that the light will come to clarify our vision, that friends will always be at our side.